From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, two NASCAR survivors on reforms at MSU. They say any change is from the bottom up, not top down.
Any change that we see on that campus is thanks to the people who were willing to fight for it and to fight against the administration for it.
Why Michigan will lose another congressional seat.
Obviously, Michigan isn't gaining population fast enough in relationship to the states in the South and the West.
GM's impending cutbacks and those state tax credits.
These mega credits, all these tax credits, cost the state about $600 million a year. That's more than we spend on community colleges in Michigan.
Plus the history of Faygo and John U. Bacon on those bowl invitations. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. General Motors is getting ready to cut thousands of salaried and hourly jobs, as well as possibly closing four U.S. plants, including two in Southeast Michigan. As Chad Livengood reports in Crane's Detroit Business, this will apparently not keep GM from cashing in on tax credits from the state of Michigan. Chad is with us now via Skype. We're talking about the mega tax credits, the Michigan Economic Growth Authority credits under the Michigan Business Tax. Briefly, Chad, remind us when and why the auto companies got these tax credits.
Well, back in 2009, near the end of that really long, arduous year for the automakers when they went through their federal bailout and then their federally supervised bankruptcy, both General Motors and Chrysler got what was renamed job retention tax credits. These mega tax credits had been around for years. They started under former Governor John Engler as ways to attract new jobs and create new jobs, and they were awarded on a per-job basis. Then Governor Granholm at the time came up with a change to it to make it a what they called a global retention credit that basically gave the company the equivalent of what the employees paying the state income tax. So they paid 4.25% of their income towards the state, and then the employer, General Motors or Ford or Chrysler, got to claim a tax credit on the same value of that employee's contribution to the state treasury. At the time, it applied to nearly 20,000 General Motors workers in the state of Michigan. This is all kind of meant to try to anchor the companies, keep them from moving any more of their operations out of the state, either through assembly or through research and development, and most importantly, probably also the headquarters of General Motors and Ford and Chrysler. So going forward, these credits, they continued to grow. Every time General Motors wanted to add more employees or do another project, they went back to the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, asked them to add more employees to their credit, which made the value of the credit grow along with their payroll. I mean, these were good years, the last several years, and so they get bonuses and pay raises, and all that factors into that credit, and the credit ballooned to the point that the state decided they wanted to have the number of jobs capped in perpetuity, and so they would have some kind of idea, a forecast, what these tax credits were going to cost the state treasury every year, because they're still in effect all the way to 2029.
As they made that agreement to cap, the Snyder administration signed a non-disclosure agreement with GM. So nobody really knows how much GM's getting in tax credits.
Yeah, as State Representative Darren Camilleri said to me, we don't know what the bargain is that we've cut here, because they kept this exact value of these tax credits for just for General Motors secretive. Ford disclosed that theirs were worth $2.3 billion for the next 15 years. Fiat Chrysler Automobiles was worth $1.7 billion. General Motors had more employees. And so kind of going forward here, they got 51,000 right now in their workforce. Their cuts, they're projecting, is a little over 8,000 they're going to cut in their salary. White-collar workforce, the majority of which is based in Southeast Michigan. And so even if they cut all of them in Michigan, they would still be above the cap that they're allowed to claim on these credits. So they will presumably be able to claim as much payroll, tax credit as possible based on the way that the deal is set up.
I know you quote Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, if you're going to cut jobs, should we continue to give people the same tax credits we've given in the past? What kind of answers did you hear from lawmakers to that question?
Yeah, there's definitely some consternation about this. Part of it is I talked to legislators who have GM plants in their districts, like Jim Anandick, who has the GM truck plant in Flint, and Representative John O'Reilly, who has the Lake Orion plant in his district. A lot of lawmakers want to at least start with at least bringing some transparency to this system, because essentially these mega credits, all these tax credits, cost the state about $600 million a year. That's more than we spend on community colleges in Michigan. That would be basically one third of the corrections department's budget. This is real money that actually comes out of the general fund every year, but doesn't get the kind of scrutiny that the community colleges or the Department of Corrections get. That's where legislators would like to start, at least shining some light on this process and having to think about it a little more. Otherwise, you just kind of get an autopilot every year. But this is money we just can't depend on anymore. And that's something that some lawmakers would like to change.
Bottom line, has GM upheld its end of this tax credit deal?
If you look at it, yes, they have. They have continued to maintain these jobs, maintain their presence. They made more investment. Part of that 2015 deal, they had to commit another $1 billion of investment. They fulfilled it the next year. If you just look at what has gone on at the GM Tech Center and some of the other plants that they've retooled, they've certainly have. I mean, the cuts and the potential closure of the Detroit Hamtramck plant and the Warren Transmission plant, they are probably more a symptom of the changing industry than an industry that's leaving.
Is this a case of hate the game, not the player?
Yeah, I mean, that's people love to hate on these tax credits. But if you look at the larger policy that Governor Jennifer Granholm set out to do to try to anchor the industry here, it's hard to argue that policy hasn't worked and that there hasn't been a long-term benefit to keeping not just the big three here, but all of their supply chain, which is really woven into the economy of Michigan.
Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
Time to talk sports and bowl games and the college football playoff with Michigan radio sports commentator John Eubank. And so the postseason rankings are out from the College Football Committee, and the top four, Alabama, Clemson, Notre Dame, and Oklahoma, sneaked in there for fourth and final team added. No Ohio State, so despite beating Northwestern and winning the Big Ten championship, they go to the Rose Bowl to play Washington. Any surprises for you in this?
Not really. There was a debate between Ohio State and Oklahoma about that last spot. They both have got one loss. But Ohio State is against Purdue by 49-20, and that's probably what killed them. Their wins are better, but their loss is worse. So there they are. But Rose Bowl against Washington is a pretty good consolation prize.
All right. And then let's go to Michigan playing Florida in the Peach Bowl December 29th in Atlanta. Do we need to see Michigan and Florida play again?
I don't.
What is this bowl invitation, anything that fans and players can go yay about?
On paper, yes, and they should. It is a Super 6 Bowl, which means top 12 teams. Michigan right now is ranked 7th. They start up being ranked 14th. Ohio State is 6th, so you're not that far off the mark, of course. That's all good, but this does not excite anybody right now. They have played Florida. This will be the third time under Harbaugh in 4 years, so that's not too exciting there, of course. And the Peach Bowl, sorry, is not the Rose Bowl.
Okay, and we know that Rashawn Gary Jr. has declared for the NFL draft, so he is not going to be playing in the Peach Bowl.
That's correct.
You know, you could make an argument where he doesn't want to risk like blowing out a knee or something when he's on the cusp of an NFL career, but then you could also make an argument to say, is he leaving his teammates in the lurch?
Both are true. Now, he declared this before that he's not going to be playing, before the game, I believe, was announced. Look, he's a third-year guy. That's all anybody expected him to do. He's the number one player recruited in the nation. 3 years ago is a huge catch for him, obviously. He's going to be 6th or 7th or 8th picked probably in the draft, which means multi-millions. It's only him and his mom. That's the whole show right there. There's no dad involved. So, yeah, it's very hard to begrudge him. His teammates do not begrudge him, I believe. But that said, as you're facing Florida, now you're waiting to see about Devin Bush. Is he going to play in this game or not? Because he's likely to declare as well for the draft. My hunch is if it was the Rose Bowl, it'd be no question that Devin Bush would be in. And the sad thing is Jake Butt, a tight end for Michigan. I'm not making any of that up, by the way.
That's right.
2 years ago, of course, played in the bowl game and blew out his knee, and it cost him millions.
Okay. Well, leave that there, and we'll keep an eye on it.
Tough call is the answer.
Very much so. All right, over to Michigan State as the Spartans play the Oregon Ducks on New Year's Eve in the Red Box Bowl in Santa Clara. Is this a bowl Spartan Nation can feel good about?
Well, when you're 7-5, it is, and they're playing 8-4 Oregon, which is a national team, basically. So it's not an elite bowl by any means, but you're 7-5. So they pulled out some games there at the end that they needed. including Rutgers, and this is not a bad reward.
Western Michigan playing BYU December 21st in the Potato Bowl in Boise, and they didn't get a bowl bid last season. So what does this year's bowl invitation tell us about how the Broncos are doing under Coach Lester?
This is a big point. P.J. Fleck, of course, went undefeated with them before the bowl game 2 years ago. Bolted from Minnesota, took some players with them, and last year was a down year, so maybe they're thinking it's a flash in the pan. But now with the new coach, they've done pretty well, and hats off to the Broncos.
All right, Eastern Michigan going to the Camellia Bowl December 15th in Montgomery, Alabama. They'll face Georgia Southern. A couple years ago, you were saying you thought the school should end the football program and put the money and resources elsewhere. Do you still think that?
I do. I think that Coach Creighton at Eastern Michigan has done a phenomenal job, and to be 7-5 there is hard work. It is the graveyard of coaches, not the cradle, the graveyard. Is where careers die, and he's doing an amazing job. But it still costs $1,000 of every $10,000 of in-state tuition goes to athletics, and most of that goes to football and a program that even when they're winning, no one seems to care about very much. I think this is a poor use of resources.
Central Michigan is making it official today. A new head coach for the Chippewas. Tell us about this new coach with the Michigan ties.
Not new to Michigan fans, of course. Coach McElwain was at Florida last year when Michigan beat them in the debut game.
And an ugly firing.
And then came to Ann Arbor, and being the wide receiver coach, did a very good job, as expected. Fit in very well with the staff, nice guy, but nobody thought he's going to be here very long. When you're the head coach of a Power 5 team, you're not going to be a position coach all that long.
This was a landing spot.
Clearly, and that was the understanding, I believe.
Yeah.
So Central Michigan, I think, got a very good deal.
What's he bring to the Chips?
Experience, probably a national recruiting base because he knows Florida. Look, man, you better get some players out of Florida if you want to beat the big boys. And Central Michigan, unlike Eastern Michigan, is a launch pad for a lot of great careers. And I bet he ends up somewhere else after this as well. This will not be his last stop, is my guess.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, the flavorful history of Faygo, one of Detroit's most iconic companies.
One flavor actually exploded in the bottles, and that was the pineapple orange, which unfortunately was initially made with unpasteurized pineapple juice.
That story's next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Want a happy trip down memory lane? Here you go.
Remember when you were a kid? Well, part of you still is. And that's why we make Faygo.
That jingle represents one of Detroit's most iconic companies. Faygo, born on Detroit's east side more than 100 years ago, and Faygo Pop is still being bottled there. Michigan State University journalism professor Joe Grimm has written a history of the company appropriately titled The Faygo Book. Joe Grimm, good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
What inspired you to write The Faygo Book?
Well, one story is I think it was because I got so thirsty writing about Coney Islands. But it could be that it's because of commercials like that that I grew up really loving Faygo.
I, too, grew up drinking it, watching those commercials. For anyone who didn't do that and might not be familiar with Faygo, it is Detroit's pop. And, Joe, isn't Faygo the reason that we call it pop and not soda?
Actually, that's not quite true. Pop had been called that for a long time before Faygo came. But Faygo has been ahead of most any other company in insisting that we call it pop. And because of that, the Detroit area calls it pop more frequently than any other part of the country.
Now, tell us about the two immigrant brothers from Russia, how they came to Detroit and then hit on the idea of, instead of baking, making soda pop.
Well, Ben and Perry Fagenson came and arrived first in Cleveland, and then the older brother, Perry, moved to Detroit. Ben stayed back in Cleveland working for his in-laws who had a pop company. Perry started baking in Detroit, and he got so sick and tired of baker's hours that he called his brother up, and they decided to get out of baking and get into pop making. And for their first flavors, they actually used frosting recipes.
I love it. What were those first Faygo flavors?
There were three: fruit punch, strawberry, which we call red pop, and grape.
That was, I know they launched the company November 4th, 1907. How long before the brothers realized that they had something that people wanted to buy and this was a product that was going to last?
Well, it didn't come right away, but by 1912, they had enough money that they were buying a truck instead of delivering everything in a horse wagon. So I think within a few years, with Detroit's population just booming, they figured it out and they started investing.
How did the growth of Faygo mirror the social and economic changes that were happening in Detroit in the early 20th century?
Well, it's interesting because the company for its entire life has stayed in a very small area on Detroit's Near East Side in what was the Jewish enclave and then became the African-American neighborhood, the only one in the city at that time. And the area was growing so quickly that Faygo grew right along with it. And as the city's population peaked and then began to decline, Faygo started thinking about how can we find more markets.
And how did they go about that?
Well, this was a real challenge because they were very loyal to their East Side neighborhood and their employees were loyal to them. And they felt that to get the land they needed to build a bigger plant, they might have to move out of the city. So this was a real struggle between loyalty and what they thought was their new destiny.
Yeah, how did it get resolved?
Well, it's kind of surprising. What happened was Mort Fagenson, who was part of the second generation of Fagensons to run the company, decided that the gas crisis was making it unwise to expand and run trucks all over the country. They said, well, we're going to stay right here. We're going to continue to bottle mostly in Detroit. They're in about 40-some states now, but they do not have big distribution centers all around the country. And as it turned out, in the 1980s, the Fagenson family sold the company to a company called TreeSweet, which, little did they know, was on its way into bankruptcy. And TreeSweet held Faygo for just 14 months before National Beverage came along and sort of rescued everything by buying the company.
I want to circle back, though, to that second generation. It's interesting.
Sure.
We see this story a lot where somehow that second generation handoff is sometimes when companies founder and fail. So what was different here with this second generation?
Well, they were very lucky that they had a pretty big group of people coming behind the founders, those brothers. And so they were able to pass the company to two brothers and a cousin, Mort, Herman, and Phil, who were veterans of World War II, decorated veterans, I might say. And after they came back from the war, they were at the right age to take over the company from Perry, the surviving brother.
It was in good, able hands.
It was in good hands, and they were ready to go.
Now, I'm interested, as you did your research, Joe Grimm, into Faygo, what have been some of the most successful and iconic Faygo flavors, and what are some of the ones that flopped?
Oh, that's a very good question. Top of most everybody's list has got to be Red Pop, of course, and it had a good push from advertising, and it's a great flavor. Rock and Rye is very popular. Faygo has won national awards for its root beer and its orange. A flavor that did not do well was a apple pop called Eve. You can't find that anywhere. And one flavor actually exploded in the bottles, and that was the pineapple orange, which unfortunately was initially made with unpasteurized pineapple juice.
Ooh, and it exploded in the bottles, so that didn't work so well.
It was a big mess. It was busting out the lights in the factory. It was banned from Dearborn. They had to drive around and pick up all this messy, these exploded bottles, and remake the pop then with pasteurized pineapple juice.
We're seeing Americans become much more aware of the health impacts of too much sugar and moving away from soda and towards water. Some places, some cities have put in sugar taxes. How is Faygo responding to those challenges?
The soft drink business is very hard, I would say. There's been problems with sweeteners, and of course those are related to all kinds of health concerns, whether it's an artificial sweetener or like a cane sugar. pop consumption is down. And the way that Faygo has been responding is they were one of the first companies to really get into the diet business, and that helped them because they were responding in a positive way. They were able to quickly turn things around because they had chemists and scientists and flavor masters in their factory. And when cyclamates were banned, Faygo came out right away before almost anybody else with new flavors that were cyclamate-free. But it's still a tough business. People are moving more and more to sparkling waters and tea and other beverages.
Is there a sense that you were able to get through all of your research as far as the long-term outlook for this iconic company?
Well, one thing that really helps Faygo these days is that National Beverage is the manufacturer of LaCroix, which owns about 20 or 25% of the sparkling water market. So that could help Faygo that it's in with another beverage that is aimed for the future.
What most surprised you as you worked on this book? What did you learn?
I was really happy to discover the loyalty that ran through the company. The first generation ran the company for 40 years, and so did the second generation. And many, many employees worked there for 30, 40, 50 years. And that was a nice surprise. And another one was the fact that the Fagansons employed a lot of African-American people because of the neighborhood they were in, and they stuck by those people even when new unions and some of their customers objected to the number of black employees they had.
Interesting. And as we see in your book, Faygo's fourth factory, the present factory, still turning out pop on Detroit's east side. What's your favorite Faygo flavor?
Oh, I have a lot, but my top flavor is rock and rye.
Rock and rye, and I'm a cream soda girl.
That's a good flavor.
MSU journalism professor Joe Grimm, his new book is The Faygo Book, taking us into the iconic Detroit company that's been churning out pop for over a century. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
And you can learn more about the Faygo Book at events this week in Hamburg and Grosse Pointe. Just go to thefaygobook.org. The federal government's National Climate Assessment was released the day after Thanksgiving. This landmark report, compiled by 13 federal agencies, spells out the ways we're seeing damage from global warming, damage that is accelerating. One of the scientists who contributed to this report is with us now. Maria Carmen Lemos is one of the writers of the Midwest chapter. She focused on how climate change impacts at-risk communities. Maria Carmen Lemos co-directs the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment Center at the University of Michigan. Maria, let me begin by quoting something from this report. Negative impacts related to climate change are projected to affect human systems, including cities, rural and coastal communities, and tribes. What kinds of negative impacts?
Well, we're already seeing some of those impacts in the way that people are having to respond to more extreme weather and climate events. So, for example, you know, extreme heat is really challenging the ability of many households, especially poor households, to respond to that impact. You know, if you don't have an air conditioning or if you don't have a means of actually regulating your microclimate inside your household, you are exposed. And that is something that is going to happen more and more, and it will disproportionately affect people with fewer resources.
And what other things besides heat?
So, for instance, you can think about tribes. You know, tribes do care a lot about their environment, their ecosystem. So they are already concerned about the effects that climate change will have long term on losing some crops, losing parts of the ecosystems that they value. And other groups are going to be affected as well. You know, you're going to have more flooding, more storms, and that will push the infrastructure, especially, for instance, in Michigan, where the infrastructure in many places is aging, especially in legacy cities. That will test our ability to continue improving well-being in that context.
So I'm thinking of some of the heavy, heavy rainstorms, for example, in the Detroit area that we mm-hmm. see. And what happens? You have big freeway flooding.
Yes.
People's basements flood. Is
exactly.
that the kind of infrastructure stress?
That is
stress?
The kind of thing that is going to continue to happen and probably be exacerbated. And it will affect all of us.
What are potential impacts, first on life and limb, on health and mm-hmm. safety, and then on our economy?
Yeah. All of those impacts are on top of bad things that are already happening. Mm-hmm. So they will, for instance, threaten our ability to offset gains that we have already made in terms of economic recovery, mm-hmm. for instance, in the state of Michigan. So this is a potential threat. Another aspect of this is that, you know, any system that is already overstressed economically and socially will become even more threatened by those impacts. If you are struggling, you know, on a day-to-day basis with your income, with your health, or with the ability for you to educate your children, for instance, climate change does not spell good news for that because it will be costly.
So we might be seeing mm-hmm. warmer winters and hotter summers. Are there areas where the merits of warmer winters mm-hmm. might outweigh the cost of the hotter summers?
Scientific evidence for that is mixed, and we say that on the report. So the Midwest is one of those regions where the impacts of climate change might improve some conditions. But overall, we think that those improvements will be long-term offset by the negative effects. So I'll give you an example. There is some research that indicates that there may be migration into the area. So this area has experienced out-migration for a long time. So having more people, it might not necessarily be a bad thing, but the reasons that people are leaving might actually impose more stress on the infrastructure and the resources in the region. However, because we are understanding this can happen, you know, cities can start planning beforehand. So this is what we call this capacity to anticipate and maybe prevent and mitigate some of those effects.
Well, to that point, mm-hmm. I understand Grand Rapids and Marquette have mm-hmm. developed climate adaptation plans, although yes. they've yet to be implemented. But according to the report, they are two of only four counties mm-hmm. or cities all through the Midwest to come mm-hmm. up with a formal plan to address climate change. Mm-hmm. Why have so few communities started preparing, making plans?
I think that part of it is that we are so much better at dealing with what we can see and the reality of today. So you see, you know, we are already stressed on many aspects economically and socially. So climate change tends to be lower in the agendas of governments in general, and this is all around the world, not in the U.S. Maybe a little bit more the case in communities that are struggling right now. So the idea, and it's something that I think it should be more stressed than it is today, is that actually there is an opportunity to prevent and mitigate some of those future costs. And also, you know, focus on what we call non-regret actions, or actions that if we do, we're going to be better off no matter what. You see?
And I think, For instance,
you know, we can prepare for a better educated community that will know how to respond to an extreme event. So education is never bad. Mm-hmm. Or we can actually increase the number of green infrastructure. So the report talks a little bit about that as well. In cities, and cities are going to be better off for green infrastructures no matter what.
Instead of paving everything over,
exactly.
Let's get some green infrastructure
exactly,
in there.
Exactly. So I think that there are things that are being done, mm-hmm. and there are things that we know that can be done. We just need to accelerate them and scale them up.
Do you believe that we can make Michigan more resilient?
Oh, I think we're already making Michigan more resilient. I think the center that I co-direct, which is a consortium with Michigan State University, we have been for 8 years increasing the use of climate information in the region. We have worked with cities, we have worked with business, we have worked with NGOs and communities. And I think that the kind of work that we are doing, it's actually already having an effect. We need to do more of it and faster.
Do you think, Maria, when people turn on TV and they see the wildfires in California, they see the results of hurricanes hitting mm-hmm. Florida, hitting our southeast coast, are people starting to buy into the fact that, yes, global climate is changing and we got to do something?
I think it is right. And I think that this trend is going to increase. I think we navigate a very thin line because, you know, we don't want people to be complacent to say, oh, somebody else is doing something, so I don't have to do it myself. And climate change is a multi-scale problem. Everybody can do something to respond to it and to better prepare to it, from the individual to governments. So we navigate this very thin line in which we want people to be aware and to be, you know, concerned with things like this report that is telling us things are going to get much worse and faster than we think. at the same time, we don't want them to think that somebody else is doing it. You know, so I think that that's changing.
Well, we've talked about local governments and we've talked about response plans such as we see in Grand Rapids and Marquette and the need for that. What about in our households? Put some power into the hands of people listening to us talk right now. What can we individually do?
Well, we can be better consumers, especially better consumers of carbon. We don't see ourselves when we are using electricity as consumers of carbon, or when we are driving, we are consumers of carbon. So we know that we can do a lot of things about this. We can be more conscientious about, you know, our rain gardens and how they can help our cities to better manage stormwater, for instance. I think there are many things that you can do on the day-to-day that will improve the situation at the individual level.
Give me the top three things that people should do.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. You know, so
what can I put right in my pocket?
I would say drive less. Use less electricity in your household, and there are many things that you can do to do that. And the third one is get yourself educated, you know, for what are other things that collectively we can do.
Maria Carmen Lemos is one of the writers of the Midwest chapter of the latest National Climate Assessment. She's associate dean at the U of M School for Environment and Sustainability, and she co-directs the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessments Center. Thank you for sharing your work with us and for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Michigan is set to lose another congressional seat when new maps are drawn in a couple of years. So whose will it be and what will it mean for Michigan? We'll try to get some answers after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The census count matters. That is made clear with the realization Michigan is going to lose a seat in the House of Representatives. Kurt Metzger is a demographer. He founded the firm Data Driven Detroit, and now he serves as mayor of Pleasant Ridge. Kurt, why is Michigan going to lose another seat in Congress?
Obviously, Michigan isn't gaining population fast enough in relationship to the states in the South and the West. The population keeps moving that way, even though Michigan is seeming on the upswing and is probably going to surpass its 2010 count, but it's not gaining at the rate that other states are. So when we split up the 435 seats, obviously more will go to the Californias and the Floridas and the North Carolinas and the Georgias. So we will lose again. We got as high as 19. We're going to be down to 13.
You think of that trend. We had 19 representatives in 1970. And as you say, we'll be down to 13. Help us understand, what are the day-to-day effects of that loss?
Well, I think primarily, I mean, obviously we talk about population loss and relative to other parts of the country and how that makes Michigan look relative to others, the faster growing states. But there is that whole idea of congressional representation and the whole Midwest. I mean, Michigan is just one of a number of states in the Midwest that continues to lose congressional representation. Obviously, when bills come up or bills are proposed, you get much more attention from those areas that have larger delegations. So we continue to lose that kind of emphasis in the legislature. I think, you know, the fewer seats you have, the less voice you have in national decisions.
Which seat do you think, as a demographer and looking at the state of Michigan, what seat do you think is most at risk of going away and why?
Well, it's going to, I was just looking at some numbers. I mean, one thing that you're going to have to look at is when we go from 14 to 13 seats, each representative, since they are supposed to be as close as possible to equal in population, each one of those seats is now going to be at least 50,000 or more larger. So you're going to have to start grabbing more population. I just started in the Upper Peninsula right now. That congressional seat has 31 counties and part of a 32nd county. In order to get back to where we would expect after 2022 or after the 2020 census, you're going to have to add at least two more counties to that. And so the pressure continues to go south. My guess is that because of population gains generally in the Grand Rapids area on the western side of the state, you're going to find that loss somewhere in southeast Michigan. And you're going to, if we presume that we're going to keep two majority-minority seats, my guess is that 9th Congressional District, which right now is partially Oakland County and partially Macomb County, that might be the one to go. It's hard to guess exactly how this thing is going to play out, but that's my guess in that greater Detroit area, that the pressure is going to be you're going to have to gain more population in the 10th and the 11th and currently the 10th, 11th, 13th, 14th, and 12th. Population is going to have to come from somewhere. That area is going to be kind of constricted because of population gains, you know, that you're going to have to grab more for other districts. And so it seems like we focus in on that. My guess is it's going to be right in that, probably in the 9th district.
Now, Michigan voters, of course, approved the redistricting proposal last month, so it'll be up to that commission to decide which U.S. House seat will be lost. And you're hoping to serve on that redistricting commission.
I would love to. I mean, I don't know what my chances are, and certainly they're going to be picking names out of the hat. But I've been very interested. I got involved back 20 years ago in terms of when mapping first started looking at redistricting. And loved that, worked with a number of people who were involved in just kind of doing redistricting processes and getting more public engagement. That was the whole idea. And then we worked on Wayne County Commissioner districts and even the City of Detroit districts when I was with Data Driven Detroit. So it's always been fascinating to do and to do it in a nonpartisan way, you know, where we're not looking at voting behavior, but rather trying to look for communities of interest, try to keep counties and communities together, making sure that groups, for instance, the way the Latino community has been split up in Michigan House and Senate districts, those kinds of things don't happen. So I'm fascinated by the process. Obviously, the whole mapping process, as we've found out from the last election, has, or at least 2016, it's become so sophisticated that they can pick out individual houses and redistrict that way. I would like to get away from that. And I think that the redistricting commission could do a wonderful job to both make the districts much more competitive and much more reasonable in terms of compact and the various characteristics that we think of as a good district.
Demographer Kurt Metzger, always great talking with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In January 2018, the world stood rapt as woman after woman gave emotional statements detailing their abuse at the hands of former Michigan State University sports doctor Larry Nassar, who is now serving what amounts to a life sentence. Since then, every few weeks seems to bring some new headline about accountability for the adults who failed to stop Nassar's abuse. It's also been a year of intense media attention on sexual assault. What has all of that been like to be a survivor of Nassar's abuse in the midst of this? With us are two of those survivors. Morgan McCall is a University of Michigan student and a sexual assault activist. And Grace French is the founder of the nonprofit group The Army of Survivors. Both women sought treatment from Nassar for dance injuries. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So in recent weeks, criminal charges have been filed against former MSU president Luana Simon and former Spartan gymnastics coach Kathy Klegas. Morgan McCall, are these charges a move in the right direction in terms of that accountability? Is it enough?
Absolutely, it's a move in the right direction. You know, we are never going to get full justice. We can never undo the damage that has been done. But these are really the steps towards accountability and healing for these women as we move forward with our lives.
And what's your take, Grace? Is this enough?
Like Morgan was saying, it's never going to be enough. I do think this is a step in the right direction. I think there are lots more steps that can be taken and making sure that everybody is held accountable.
And what kind of steps do you have in mind?
One for sure would be an apology, I think, from Michigan State. There are so many people who were hurt by this, and not just survivors, but parents and the community and the lying that has happened since then, or people who are still waiting for an answer from MSU, and they just seem to not understand the hurt that they have caused and are still causing.
Now, I know the school has made some policy changes in the wake of the Nassar scandal. We've explored them here on Stateside. Do you feel as though the university is making a good faith effort to put things right, Morgan?
I do. I think that that comes from the collective of staff and students who have really stood up and used their voices for what's right. Now, the same cannot be said coming out of the administration in the Hanna building. They have made incredible derogatory statements about survivors. They've gone back on their word time and time again. They have turned out student activists and survivors in the most important of days. Any change that we see on that campus is thanks to the people who were willing to fight for it and to fight against the administration for it.
When you say people, certainly those of you in the sisterhood of survivors have done that. Who has been doing it right, in your view, amongst the community of the college, of the university?
I mean, I spent a lot of time working with a student group called Reclaim MSU. They've been one of my closest allies throughout the past year in doing activism on campus and kind of being the boots on the ground when we can't always be there.
What's your take, Grace?
I think with MSU, one of the things that a lot of the survivors have been calling for and the community has been calling for since the beginning is transparency. And while some of the administration believes that transparency has been completed and that they are working towards that goal, it's hard to see that when you start seeing some of the changes, like the presidential search being closed to the public, when there are certain decisions that are being made behind closed doors that go against what they say they're moving toward. It really is harmful towards their vision of complete healing from this.
I'm speaking with Morgan McCall and Grace French, both of them survivors of abuse committed by Larry Nassar. Thinking of this intense year of media coverage, Morgan McCall, when you consider all of the reporting and all the coverage of survivors' experience and of Larry Nassar, what do you think the things are they got right?
I think that using media in order to empower survivors' voices, providing us a platform to speak for ourselves on behalf of ourselves and to let us fight for what we believe should come in the aftermath of these horrible assaults has been invaluable. And it's something that survivors have been denied for so long. Being able to tell our stories and being able to change the course of our stories as we see fit has been very important.
Grace French, what do you think the media coverage has missed or gotten wrong?
I think one of the biggest things I've heard call out from a couple of survivors is just, and this may be superficial in some ways, but the ways that the media puts Nassar's face on the front of every single news coverage. And I think a lot of the survivors find this very triggering when scrolling through their news feeds or when looking up news about what's happening in our case or the outcomes afterwards. That's one of the biggest things that I've heard so far just called out about what's hurting. I think in general, it's been great to have our voices heard and to be amplified by the media, like Morgan was saying, and that's been so much more important than anything so far.
When you've had now these months since those powerful moments in the courtroom that we all saw last January with the victim impact statements, as you look back and you've kind of processed this, why were you both willing to come forward and to share your stories? Morgan, I'll start with you.
So I had actually come forward a few months prior to impact statements after a round of mediation with MSU that was unsuccessful. I came forward because I did not feel that the university recognized the value of a life, and I did not believe that the university understood the depth of the damage that they had done by contributing to this culture that produced so many victims. And then I spoke in court for me. That was something that I was able to use to kind of launch both into my adulthood as I turned 18, but also to kind of close a chapter in my life that involved Larry Nassar. Moving forward from that point, I was able to focus it on advocacy and on activism, on righting the wrongs for so many people, not just myself. And that was incredibly cathartic.
And Grace, I know not only did you share your story, but you have founded the Army of Survivors. What impelled you to go ahead and take that step and come forward in this way?
I think understanding that a name at some point does mean so much and that we're not just a number anymore, and understanding that this has impacted us as a person and as somebody who was a child at the time and somebody who was 12 when the abuse started. Having a voice is powerful in itself, but I think having a name to it, you're able to connect to the person more freely than I think a number. And I think that activism has helped me heal in so many ways that coming forward has been such a journey and such a healing process that I don't think I would have had if I were keeping it to myself. Not to say that keeping it to yourself is bad. I think it's important to come out at your own time and to do what you need to do in order to heal.
When you think of this time you have now spent in the spotlight, talking to people like me about such a very personal and a painful thing that had happened to you. So you had your life altered by what happened with Nassar. And now, as you say, you've put faces and names to these stories. How has it been for you? How has that changed you, the process of sharing and talking to the media, Morgan?
Throughout my interaction with media, specifically related to my abuse, it's gotten a lot easier to talk about it. I often say that my activism, specifically interacting with platforms like Michigan Radio, has been a sort of therapy. It's not traditional, but it allows me to kind of create some positive retroactive noise on behalf of the little girl that I was that couldn't do so. It has been difficult, but it's been an honor.
And Grace, how about you?
I think having a voice and the momentum behind this case in order to use my voice for something so good and so powerful has been such an honor, and it's helped me to be able to process the story even more and to understand how people will see the story through the media that it's gotten has been so impactful in how I see myself as a survivor as well.
Grace French, Morgan McCall, we want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many of Larry Nassar's victims did not know they'd been sexually abused until the fall of 2016, when Rachel Den Hollander told her story to the Indy Star. For survivor Trinae Ganzar, it took even longer. In this week's episode of Believed, what it's like to realize that someone you love, someone you trust, is a predator. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells takes us to the moment when Trinae learned Larry had been put on leave by Michigan State University after Amanda Tomasho filed a Title IX report.
At that point in 2014, Trinae is traveling overseas. So she messages Larry on Facebook.
What's going on? Are you all right? And he'd be like, oh, I'm okay. Like, you know, just send prayers and, you know, we're going to get through it together and such and such.
And Larry did get through it again.
Each time Larry was believed instead of his accusers, Trinae's trust in Larry is reaffirmed. It is legitimate treatment. Poor guy, it's just misunderstood. So when Trinae sees Rachel's story in the Indy Star in 2016, she's sad, sure, but sad for Larry, sad for his wife, Stephanie, their kids.
And I felt really bad for her, Jim, you know, all these people that love this person, like so much love for him.
It might sound strange, but Trinae's belief in Larry, it doesn't fade, not right away. I mean, she's got 30 plus years of love for this guy.
Listen to episode 7 of Believed, What Have You Done? You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. New episodes out every Monday. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Lindsay Scullin, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.